All right, we'll make a start, even as a few people still wander into the room. My name's Amanda Aitken. I'm a director at Actuarial Edge, and I'll be chairing today's session with the topic Review of Government-Sponsored Insurance Schemes. This topic's obviously very topical, given recent public debate over the rising cost of home insurance in flood-prone areas such as far north Queensland. John will be talking for about 25 to 30 minutes, which should give us plenty of time for questions and answers at the end of the session. Can I just remind you again to please put your phones onto silent and at the end of the session to complete the online feedback survey. Hopefully everyone's managed to work out where that is by now. So Professor John McEnany is the Managing Director of Risk Frontiers, an independent R&D company based at Macquarie University in Sydney. Risk Frontiers is devoted to helping insurers, reinsurers and broking intermediaries better understand and price catastrophe risks in the Asia-Pacific region. It also works with government in respect to managing natural hazard risks. John is the author of approximately 120 scientific papers. I've got a long way to go before I get anywhere near that number, John, in areas of quantitative risk analysis, natural perils and environmental physics. He's also the author of two books, Where Wine Flows Like Water, which chronicles the adventures of John and a friend as they walked the pilgrimage trail across Spain to Santiago de Compostela, and a novel called Shifting Sands about corruption in a scientific organisation. This is sure to be a very interesting presentation. Thanks very much, John.
That scientific organisation wasn't Risk Frontiers, I just want to make clear. So this talk is, well, thank you, Amanda, and for everyone coming. This talk is sort of bigger than the title, really, because it was the study was motivated by concerns about how government should react to the rising cost of natural disasters, and also what was the contribution of the insurance sector to that. Now, the talk is really a summary of the key findings of this paper that was published in the beginning of this year. It was funded initially by the National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility, and then we just kept working on it, sort of funding it ourselves, and I'd hate to think about how long we have spent on this, but as Amanda said, there are some things about it that are quite important. If we look at the co-authors there, Delphine did most of the real work. Raid, who you may know, used to be at Aon Benfield in Sydney. He's part of your club. He's an actuary. And he provided some of the conceptual sort of understanding, and particularly trying to figure out which questions to ask. And because of his previous involvement in Florida with the Florida Farm Bureau, with whom he worked for a long time, he knew the situation in Florida very intimately. George Walker, if anyone knows him, won't be surprised that he argued with everybody and about everything and provided a lot of quality control, which was important, but also because of his deep involvement with the wind engineering community globally, of which Texas is a key part, Texas Tech. He knew the situation in Texas as well. And Ryan's one of my colleagues, and he contributed other things which I won't have time to talk about. So a brief outline. I'm going to quickly go through quick sketches, if you like, of the different pools that we looked at. It's a not an exhaustive list, but I think it sort of samples from the spectrum of possibilities and the challenges that they all face in trying to deal with this issue. And then we pose three questions. So how is risk priced? That was a sort of a key interest of mine. How are deficits funded? And that's where one of the things that Raid was keen on and turned out to be very important. And does the pool encourage disaster risk reduction? And once we talk about risk reduction, then you can't avoid talking about a lot of the home goals that happen in Australia, sort of the amplification of natural disaster costs due to poor land use planning. And the sort of other question is, can risk reflect of premiums change everything? Can insurance be an agent of change? So one of the things that you also have to realise that at least if you're comparing our situation with what happens in the States, it's the insurance systems in both are very different. And that wasn't clear to me immediately. So post-Brisbane, most homeowners' policies are multi-peril and cover most things except actions of the sea, but also include tsunami and storm surge. And some companies are actually covering coastal erosion as well. Also, we don't have key concentration risks like, say, Wellington, Miami or Tokyo. We don't have it's true that if we were to have even a modest earthquake in Sydney or Melbourne or one of the other big centres, it would be incredibly expensive and it would be a real mess. But we don't have known faults under the city or close by, as is the case of Wellington in both those instances. Premiums are not regulated as yet, and where that's not true in the United States, there's a lot of political pressure to keep premiums down. And of course, there's a lot of new technology now that most companies are tending to use and is available to them, and that's sort of leading to risk reflective premiums. So now let's look at some of these pools. The first one we looked at is the National Flood Insurance Program. Of the pools that we looked at, it's the only one that is truly a national one, and really it's only an insurance scheme in name only for reasons which will become clear as the talk develops. Basically, it's run by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and where the government provides an overdraft facility, which is very heavily used at the moment. It was created in 1968 after the threatened withdrawal of insurers after floods following Hurricane Betsy in 1965, and it had earlier problems in the 1920s with flooding on the Mississippi. One of the things that I, again, wasn't conscious of until we started the study was it also covers storm surge losses in addition to other types of flooding. So you can imagine it's really like the situation we used to have here where you were trying to separate riverine and flooding and flash flooding. So if you have a hurricane hits Florida or Texas, you have to separate out those two things, which will be a mess, I'm sure. The Californian Earthquake Authority actually isn't really a government-run one, although I'm sure government was involved in setting it up. It's run by the private sector, and it came about because when the Northridge earthquake in 1994 occurred, only a third of homeowners had in the area impacted had insurance, so they had to buy that as an extra thing. And the insurers were up to $15 billion worth of claims and had collected $3.4 billion in premiums over the previous 25 years. So they didn't like that calculus or algebra and were threatening to leave. In the end, they could leave, but they had to pay a tax towards this new authority and keep offering insurance for seismic risk. Most chose to stay and be part of it. It has no government guarantee, which sets itself apart from most of the other US pools. So it has to make do on premiums and retained earnings. But still, 88% of homeowners in California, it may actually be in Los Angeles and other places that are more at risk, choose to self-insure, so it's not a big take-up of that scheme. Citizens really went through lots of changes, but it came about in the 1960s when there was a crisis in insurance availability, and then mortgage finance was conditional on having insurance. It then went through nearly 30 years of fairly benign hurricane activity, in which case the population of coastal parts of Florida expanded enormously. And then we had Hurricane Andrew in 1992. Seven, I think, insurers went bust, and another four would have, but they were bailed out by their national counterparts. So it's funded by premiums, assessments and bonds, and you need to know a little bit about assessments. What they do is that they're sort of levies on participating insurers to help run Citizens. So they're regular assessments, but if they have a big event, then they add assessments on to back on the companies and they feed back into premiums until the debt is paid off. The insurers are all obliged to participate in the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, which provides low-cost insurance. And, of course, one of its virtues is it concentrates risk in the state. And while Citizens is beginning to dabble in the reinsurance market, hitherto it hasn't. Texas is much the same in that respect. So New Zealand and Spain, most of you know about the Earthquake Commission, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. But the Consorcio in Spain is very, very similar. In fact, the EQC started out of a war damage and earthquake commission, and the Consorcio was first introduced to cover damage in the Spanish Civil War, 1936, I think, 1939. It's a state-run public private partnership, and it's funded by levies on, I think, on all insurance policies. So the difference between it and the EQC, whereas EQC is a sort of a levy on homeowners insurance, and in Spain it's on life insurance, it's on personal accident insurance, car insurance and so on. So it has a much bigger subsidisation base, if you like. And it's not obligatory that insurers participate, but most do and take a 5% transaction fee and flick the risk onto the consortio. Again, it's backed by a government guarantee. France, the French system, it's obligatory. I think all the homeowners policies in France have to have a natural disaster component to them. And the Caisse Centrale de Réassurance is a scheme that is a reinsurance scheme, really. And again, it's not obligatory, but most companies participate, and it's operated as a sort of a quota share arrangement. And they've had a few issues, which I'll talk about later, but and prices have gone up quite a lot. But it's based on the principle of natural solidarity, so, you know, one for all and all for whatever. And so it's sort of a socialisation of the system. Flood Re, we were in the middle of the study when that started to so they were beginning to talk about it. In the UK, flood insurance has been provided by the private sector since about the 1960s. It was based on a gentleman's agreement, as they used to call it, where the insurers would look after the would offer policies, but the and the government was supposed to look after mitigation. That agreement worked really well until it started raining and things started to fall apart, and the insurers said, well, if you don't do your bit, we're not going to do ours. So they then developed a set of principles, and finally, after a long period of time and after more floods, they came to Flood Re. And so what it is, basically, it's a private sector run thing. They take all of their worst risks and put them into a single fund, so like a bank that accumulates the worst risks, and they shed the cost of that on everyone else. But because it's a very large subsidising base, it only works out about £10 per property. And the government has promised, again, to deal with mitigation and also to cover the tail risk, so events greater than a 1 in 200-year event. And it's not clear from our reading whether that works on a 1 in 200-year event on a single catchment or whether it's over the whole country where there's flooding. Now, they may have thought through that, it's just we don't know. In the Netherlands, totally different. The problem is so big from flooding, with over 50% of the land area underwater, under sea level, sorry, trying to avoid being underwater. And so the government, after really large loss floods and a storm in 1953, which also had large losses in the UK and indirectly started the movement towards the Thames barrage. But in the Netherlands, they put up these dikes, which you probably all know about, and also a lot of a series of levees. And the commitment from the government is that the outer circle of dikes is good for a 1 in 10,000 year event. So basically, they're saying that this is too big an issue to leave to the private sector. If the Netherlands is going to be open for business, that's the sort of protection we need. So now we come on to the three questions. So how is risk priced? Well, in New Zealand, in France and in Spain, it's all based on these social principles. These words actually come out from the Concordia's manifesto for compensation, solidarity and cooperation. The premiums are all set by decree and they do not reflect individual risks. Now, NFIP, that's the National Flood Program in the US, it sort of aims to be actuarially sound, and that's a fairly nebulous concept I'm learning. Actuarially sound in the case of NFIP means that they can deal with an average historical year. And if you think about floods in this country or bushfires, most years there aren't any. So the average historical year is actually the losses, and that would be very, very low. And so they... And the way they deal with bigger stuff is really to go back to government. So the Government Accounting Office declared it actuarially unsound by design. There's lots of subsidies and things that are built into the system. In 2011-12, the Senate actually got serious and tried to improve it. They wanted to move towards risk-based pricing and get rid of some of the sort of repetitive loss homes and risks. And, of course, that meant that for some people, premiums would have gone up. I think only about 8% would have been affected, it's claimed, but that was too much for some senators, and so 2 years later the Homeowners Flood Insurance Affordability Act came in and changed most of those, reversed most of those new conditions. So it sort of shows you how politically difficult it is to sort of change things, I guess. In Citizens and in Texas, the premiums are not risk-based and the changes are highly regulated, but they are now moving towards a more actuarially sound premiums, where actuarially sound in this case means they can cover a 1 in 100 year loss without resorting to assessments on policyholders and insurers, so out of their retained funds. And Delphine was able to listen to sort of like a YouTube or a video of one of their board meetings and at the TWIA, and somebody asked the chief actuary whether they could deal with more than a 1 in 100 year loss or if there was one in another season. And the answer was, well, yes, well, actually no, but that's very unlikely. So forgetting about 2004 and 5. So now, how do they deal with the deficits? Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy basically made NFIP technically insolvent. First, its debt capacity with the federal government was raised from $1.5 billion to $23 billion, and then again up to $31 billion. And the idea is that they're supposed to pay that all back with interest. They're now at $23 billion in debt, and their annual premium is about $3.5 billion. In Florida, after the longest hurricane drought on record, we've had 11 seasons without a Cat 3 or above going across the coast, and it's Cat 3 and 4, 5 that caused most of the damage. They're now in surplus, but if they went into deficit, that would be funded by surcharges and emergency assessments, which I talked about before, and that happened after Andrew in 1994. 2. So they're getting to the point where they think that they're close. Some properties are priced appropriately, and they've actually offered reductions in premiums for some of the ones homeowners further away from the coast, and are putting out some of the ones in a limited extent on the coast, the ones most at risk. 2011, the Texas scheme was placed on administrative oversight, and 2 years later they considered insolvency, but they had been depopulating their exposure. So rather than competing with the private sector and trying to win market share by having lower and lower premiums, they started to get serious, and they're trying to shed as much risk as they can onto the private sector now. And the Californian Earthquake Authority has got no government guarantee. So if they have big losses, then there'll be surcharges on premiums. And remember, there's not a lot of them. And also prorated payouts until the debt is covered. EQC, you know about, they went through their $6 billion accumulated losses since 1945. The government guarantee was necessary to capitalise the French system after large floods and windstorms around the turn of the century. In Spain, they've got a growing surplus, partly because of this wide subsidising base, but also because they've had a fairly benign claims history. But of course, that was also true in New Zealand until recently. Flood Re, it's managed by the private sector, like I said, and the government responsible for the really big losses, and just how you define that is not known, at least to us. And in the Netherlands, it's a government responsibility, so it's not... So do they encourage risk reduction? Well, the overall thing, particularly in the US schemes, is that it's all about trying to provide low-cost insurance to people at high risk, and some people find that a bit contradictory. But in NFIP, insurance is mandatory with federal-backed mortgages, but I don't think there's ever any auditing of that, so you could, in principle, get the insurance and then stop buying it. One of its positive things is there's a lot of local authorities that accept their floodplain management advice, and therefore people in those communities get reductions in premiums. But critics of the scheme say that it hasn't stopped the development on the floodplains, and also that a lot of the maps are either wrong or politically drawn rather than by hydrologists. It's not clear to me how they're dealing with storm surge exposure, which, as I said, was responsible for most of their problems. And about 1% of properties count for 25 to 30% of claims, and that's because they're not allowed to reconsider, insuring people who have had insurance, even if they have gained a better understanding of the risk. The Texas scheme, one of the good things it's done is that there's an expectation that when you buy a property now in Texas that they'll have a certification that's been mandated by TWIA and certified by the Department of Texas Department of Insurance. And while they charge everybody the same along the coast, and that might be reasonable. It's probably the risk isn't changing very much across there, but you can get discounts if your home is built properly. And the Californian system, well, the update of it is so small that it really doesn't have much influence on future losses. With EQC, it supports a lot of R&D and promotes developments and building codes. It does a lot of good stuff, but there's no incentive on individuals to retrofit because the premiums are not risk rated. So wherever you are, if you're five metres from the fault in Wellington, or you're living in Northland where there's almost no earthquake risk, you'll be paying the same amount. So, and if you updated your house, then who's going to get the benefit of that? It's probably the insurance company. So if you're If you're on the edge of a cliff just above the fault, you might as well wait until your house falls down and then be funded to build another one. It doesn't work if you're in the house when it goes off the cliff, but you can't have everything. With CCS, the uniform fees don't encourage risk-reducing measures. What they have come to a realisation is building levees isn't necessarily a good idea in terms of reducing risk because you get more development behind them. And flood re, there's a couple of positive things, I think. The government, of course, has got the responsibility for mitigation, but homes built post-2009 can't be included. So I assume that means that houses built after that have to be built off the floodplain, or at least if they're on the floodplain, in ways that makes them less, more resilient in the case of floods. And the aim is to move towards risk-reflective pricing over 25 years, which is sufficiently long that no one will be worried. So let me just sum up. Sorry, there's lots of words. I should have borrowed some of Will's equations, but get the actuaries excited. But I think this stuff's sort of important. Government pools can raise funds post-event, whereas private insurance have to pay everything in advance through reinsurance or retained losses. Private insurance systems usually attract taxes on profits and retained earnings, but that's not true of government scheme. Although we have seen with ARPC where the government decides to take an efficiency dividend from it, so it's a bit the same. And also the EQC's National Disaster Fund was under threat for a while until cooler heads prevailed. Also, the government can use its sovereign right to power to compel one group of consumers to subsidise another, and that's a natural thing that comes out when everybody pays the same. And whereas private insurance systems operating in a competitive market, like Australia, then increasingly compelled to set prices related to risk. I stole this slide from Hugh Cowan from EQC, and I think it's quite nice because it sort of points out that insurance is just part of the sort of spectrum of things that we might use to deal with disasters. So this is the loss getting higher, and this is the frequency. So if the loss is really high, this is where you should see land use planning come into effect, and we saw that after Christchurch with areas being designated as no-build zone because of liquefaction. But you know, the city itself is being rebuilt, but to building code standards that are actually higher than what are in Melbourne. And then there's a part where insurers can play their part, but remember that it's not a risk reduction mechanism except in a financial sense. It won't stop the event from happening. So then we start looking at issues related to land use planning. I've talked about some of these before, so I'll go through them fairly quickly. But bushfire, you know, we proudly talk about Victoria as being the bushfire capital of the world, the most dangerous place to live in case of bushfires. But then you go to places like King Lake, where the dark here is the bush, and these are the houses, the circles. The red ones are lost. The white, the open circles are the survived structure. The wind's coming from this direction in this particular case. And so as you move further away from the bush, you see much less broken, burnt homes. Now, if you look at Marysville and King Lake, 25% of the homes that were destroyed were within 1 metre, and that's sort of a notional 1 metre. It means that we can't tell the difference with very high-resolution aerial photography. And we've probably gone and done post-event surveys of about a couple of dozen fires now. We've looked back through old aerial photographs, and we have all the information, the police reports from 1967 Hobart fires, and the only thing that really comes out that is a sort of a common thread through all of that is distance from bush. The further you're away, the safer you are. Brisbane, similar sort of story. This graph shows, the red shows the extent of flooding in the 2011 event. The white stuff tells you where the modelling said it should go, and you can see it's a very good agreement. But again, between 2006 and 2011, the City Council approved another 1,800 developments in those areas that were subsequently flooded. Most companies aren't offering protecting against this type of damage. This is Collaroy. We had a what's called a black nor'easter, and so it's an east coast low, but the wave are coming from a different direction from the nor'east. And the modelling that we can do now shows how these eddies are set up, just that scour the beach in this very place that it's happened. Okay, so that looks dreadful, but in 1974 it was exactly the same. I think in the 1956 it was also the same. So while we can model it now and the science is getting better, we can understand it. It's the morphology of the beach and the wave direction that quite modest wave heights, to be honest, compared with what we can get. We're seeing going through the same dramas about how do we deal with this. Yeah, okay, I'll tidy up pretty quickly. Whinging about poor land use planning, of course, is not new, but it's nice to have someone to blame and to have some sort of precedent. Governor Macquarie in 1819 was fed up with people, farmers, losing things on the Hawkesbury Nepean. The second quote comes from Van der Wink and a cast of thousands who, after the Hurricane Andrew in Florida and the Northridge earthquake, were saying, yeah, why does this keep happening? Don't we learn? And the answer is we don't, or it's very complicated to change people's behaviour, I guess, would be another explanation. And also the Gilbert White, who was a well-known geographer, this is a quote out of his thesis in 1945. So just a couple of things then to tidy up. Can risk reflective premiums change anything? You know, that's the way we're going in the country at the moment. The technology allows it, and it's hard to sort of go backwards. It's too early to say, I think, whether they're being effective or not. But if you think about the converse, who else but insurers have an explicit incentive to understand and price risks correctly? Local government doesn't, land developers don't, and the state government and the federal government are too far away from the problem to really understand it. And who else but insurers can reward homeowners for reducing risk? And of course then we have also the example of Roma and Emerald, where Suncorp pulled out of offering insurance in those two towns after spending what they claimed, $150 million, and had received, I think, about $4 million in premiums after they rebuilt the town three times. So that did end up in action, and so levees were built, and so that was a very positive outcome. But it was only really possible because Suncorp was the only company offering flood insurance, or mostly. Also, the people had a very high awareness of the flood, having swept water out of their homes three times in 2 years, and they realised they wouldn't have that cover. So it's not something that could happen everywhere. So I think that's really positive, because the issue is from a government perspective, and concern is that we'll end up with insurance being unaffordable. It doesn't seem to be happening, but that's the concern. And the political imperative in most of the schemes that we looked at overseas has been to provide affordable insurance to people at risk, and sometimes at very high risk. So it's all about insurance availability. They've generally been legislated in haste after a big event, and insurers saying, oh no, we can't deal with that. And then many are based on the socialist principles, where insurance is really regarded as an instrument of social policy. And we saw that with some of the reviewers in the paper. They just, or one in particular, just thought that this problem was too important to be left to scumbag insurers, the government needs to take this on, and it's only poor people who are being affected. But I think most of us would quite like to have a coastal property in New South Wales and deal with the risk. But certainly not just the poor that are at risk. And I think that whole view, well, I don't like it, it ignores the ingrained inequity. It's often that it's poorer people who are subsidising the risk, and that's certainly the case in Florida. So quickly, conclusions. I think I've covered this first point quite often. And the fat tail nature of distributions of catastrophe losses means that very high losses are always possible, perhaps much higher than you've seen in history, and without contingent capital, either from the government or from the reinsurance market or capital markets, you can't deal with it. All of these schemes, whether it's private or government, could in principle encourage mitigation, but most don't. And we've got to remember that it's not an alternative to disaster risk management. Insurance is a mechanism that sort of diversifies, transfer risk to parties who have got a greater diversification factor possibility, but it's not going to stop the event happening. It's impossible to, I think, to ignore the role of poor land use planning, contributing to the rising costs of natural disasters. And certainly after a big event, the government's very keen to come in and blame the insurance industry, but that's there's less focus on what allowed this people to build in those places. It's too early to prove that risk-reflective premiums are encouraging risk reduction, but the converse is certainly true. I think in their absence, nothing is ever going to change. And when we look at the government schemes, I think the paradox is pretty well summed up by Jeff Ian Russell, that any well-run catastrophe insurance program is going to end up looking very much like an equivalent private market company. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. So we've got time for a couple of questions. If you have a question, could I ask you to come to the microphone in the middle and record your name just as the session's being recorded? Anyone like to get started? I'll start with a question that I have then, John, if that's all right. You mentioned to me, I think, before the presentation today that really largely local councils remain unaccountable for poor decisions that they make in relation to land use and land use planning. Apart from price signalling, which potentially can impact choices that homeowners make, what do you see as some of the best ways to provide that necessary incentive?
Well, I think it's about the only thing that I think is going to change unless government at all levels has a change of heart. And if you think about what's motivating local councils, they get their money either through land taxes or from new developments. So hardly incentivised to designate areas of land as being unsuitable. We saw a good example of that in St George's where most of the people who got whacked in those floods were on land that everybody knew was very highly flood prone. So the council's reaction to that was not guaranteed to make community happiness, because what they did is they built a levee around the people who weren't affected and left those other people on the flood-prone places without any protection. And if we go back a little bit, they had allowed, and I don't know at what time, so it could have been a long time ago, which would make it very hard to attribute liability, that land had been allowed to develop in the full knowledge that it was flood-prone. What happened when they tried to do one thing that was good was to stop building the building of a old folks aged care facility there, and what happened then is that the state government came in and overturned that decision. So it seems to me that all parts of government are sort of complicit in this, and I don't see strong any signs that it's going to change, and that's why I'm hoping that risk reflective premiums might do the trick.
Anyone else like to ask a question?
Well, that I'll take my wine and leave.
Lucky I've got wine for you. Thank you very much. Could everyone please put their hands together to thank John?